Content note, this episode of So Many Books, So Little Time contains a word that is technically a slur against people who do not speak. It's technically a slur, but it is said out loud. There's also some possible themes of bullying and teenage angst or adolescent angst, or also adolescent insecurities that might be something to prepare for in terms of topics. And it mentions school and those kind of things, which can be difficult for some folks. So please note this. Hi, folks. This is Rue.
And Dave.
And welcome to So Many Books,
So Little Time.
Today we start a new book, which is A Wrinkle in Time by Madeline Leng. And I will be pronouncing that name wrong. And I apologize in advance to any French speaker. Madeleine Leng. I can't. New book. And oddly enough, this is a book that contains the occasional illustration. So, at least in my edition and in most editions, there will be usually a few drawings, illustrations here. It was a concern I had when picking this book. But I figure I've had practice now with image descriptions for visually impaired and blind folks. So I figure I can do it. I am up for the challenge. And if I describe it poorly, then Dave will correct me. And that's fine, because Dave has an artistic eye.
I will not correct you. I will aid you.
Sorry, that is true. We'll enhance the description by providing further input. Hmm. Yes.
Yeah. So we took a week break. I mean, the break was a week long. It wasn't a week as in the opposite of a strong break.
No. So, well, yes, we took off a week for the following purpose. So I had to have a medical procedure done, and what the upshot of which is, like many people with my particular constellation of risk factors, and out of sheer luck, we discovered that I had a little lump hiding in my thyroid. And it wasn't huge, but it had to be investigated because of just the shape of it. And then we did a bit of biopsying, and then we're like, oh, okay, yeah, no, this probably is best to come out. I was given the option to, you know, wait a little bit longer and see what happens. But both the surgeon and I preferred it coming out sooner rather than later. The thing with thyroid tumors is they're usually, like, the vast majority are actually benign. Like, most growths in your thyroid are going to be benign or due to another reason, not usually something nasty or not very nasty. Hence, my voice is a bit shaky because I've had an operation last Friday. And I got the biopsy results. I was meant to get them today, but he called me in on Tuesday. So I found out far, far earlier than I thought I would. And turns out the tumor whom I dubbed Trevor the tumor residing in my thyroid. So, and I'm going to use an expression that is of the younger people's vernacular now. Trevor was yeeted along with half my thyroid. Yeet. Off it goes. So it was removed with half my thyroid and sliced and diced and investigated. And turns out it actually was a form of cancer, but we caught it at stage one. So it was quite small for the cancer side of things. We caught it at the borderline where it's large enough to want to remove it, but small enough where you could have probably waited a little longer, but it's a good thing we didn't, because it had not gone past stage one, but it was starting to become more invasive. So it was starting to kind of like the cells were kind of starting to stretch out their little podosomes and reach out for ooh, where's the blood vessels? Where's the lymph? And we caught it before it even had a chance.
It was waking up.
Yes, it existed, so it was awake, but it was starting to go from in that phase of switching over to, hi, let me get myself a nice juicy blood supply and a bit of lymph node and beef up and cause chaos and misery. So very lucky. And so this gives us the value of not ignoring that lump or that bump or that weird thing that's been happening. Like, sorry, my voice. That was a thing that kept happening as well. My voice, I would lose it a lot more. It's happening now because of inflammation from the surgery. But like, I'd lose my voice really easily. I'd be coughing a lot. I had a sore throat, which was just constant, almost constantly dry. It's getting there. And those symptoms in themselves are not something that you can go say, oh, yeah, definitely going to be a growth in the thyroid and there's cancer and whatever. No, those other risk factors also that were considered to at least have a look. I know that this is not always an option for everyone, and the intervention also is not always an option for everyone. But if you can get access to these things, get on top of things, don't delay them, do it as soon as possible. If you notice something weird and that's changed, record it and have it noted in your clinical notes by your doctor and follow up on it. Ideally, a doctor would follow up on it, but given that they are in many places flat out, especially our family doctors and the GPs, primary physicians are always exhausted. So it's good to keep a track of it for yourself. Like, pick a day of the year where you just do your maybe once or twice a year where you have your remember to follow up on this lump and bump, these lumps and bumps with my doctor. As soon as they happen, obviously get things checked, but annually try and give yourself a good thing. I know in the States they have usually annual health checkups when we have a healthcare system that's actually not strained to the edges.
She's a trooper, folks, because not only are we recording a week after she had Trevor taken out, which still makes me laugh, but we're starting a new book which Rue herself is reading. Also, I should say, you weren't the only person that had you had a medical emergency. All I had was I had my second COVID vaccine injection, and boy howdy. It doesn't happen for everyone, but the rumors were true with me. It knocked me flat on my ass the day afterwards.
Yeah.
Whoa.
usually the second dose of the mRNA vaccines, the immune system has had a chance to be warned from the first dose, but then the second dose comes and it's like, right, no, we are not dealing with this. this is not happening. You are not welcome. Go. And so it's had a bit of forewarning. And so it kind of goes, wait, I know you. You don't belong here. And it goes into the full hell no mode of operation, as we like to refer to it. And many people are describing, unfortunately, similar things with the booster shot. And unfortunately, because, I mean, it sucks feeling horrible and feeling miserable. And no doubt there will be some people where they have to consult with their physicians before having another dose, depending on how they reacted to their first and second dose. They might have to review and decide what is actually appropriate for their immune system. We do not believe in blanket immune system statements. Of course, the benefits are there. Dave and I are not going to argue on the benefits of whether vaccines help or not. It's something that someone has to decide and make a medical decision with their physicians who know their bodies as well, who are familiar with their particular medical background. So I'm not going to start that debate. But yes, so when Dave said, I've had my second dose, I said, well, I'm having there's surgery and second dose. No, it's not going to happen this week. I think no.
Yeah. So, no question, what Rue had to deal with was astronomically more severe and important.
See, I'm not a fan of. See, this is the thing. You don't correct, and I don't believe in comparing experiences. What sucks for one person? I mean, of course, you can say, "Oh, but this and there's more."
No. I think recovering from a vaccine is in no way comparable to surgery.
Depends on the person. I'm going to say for you, you do not feel that it was. Because does that make sense? So you've had experiences of both, yes, no?
Yeah.
Have you had, you've had experiences
of both. I had appendicitis when I was young.
Yeah, so you can say from your personal experience, the recovery from the surgery was worse than dealing with the immune system having a...
hiccup.
Sparta reenactment, you know. Sorry, now I'm visualizing all these white blood cells and everything. Oh. This is Sparta.
And you know, not only the stereotype about getting knocked out by the second dose, both doses, COVID arm is real as well.
Oh yeah, not that anyway. It for anyone who has had experience with COVID arm, anyone who is looking into getting vaccinated, just the trick is an ice pack on site or in the armpit. Put the ice pack in your armpit and it should help. It'll calm down that lymph node. That will help.
Now, so last time at the end of our finale of Catch-22, I asked you about why you have chosen the book, because, you know, at the end of every book, we talk about what the next book is. But, you know, because this is the beginning of a new book, a new season, a new chapter, ho, ho, ho. Some folks may be listening that did not listen to the Catch-22, so I would like to ask you again, maybe not as in much detail, but what led to you choosing A Wrinkle in Time for our next read?
So A Wrinkle in Time is, it's a fairly classic children's book, or it's considered to be a classic children's book, and it's actually from this century, or last century, not this. You know what I mean? It's not from two or three centuries ago, like my previous books have been.
It is from the last 100 years.
Yes, it's from the last 100 years as opposed to older. It's science fiction, which I enjoy. Mm. It's a children's book, but it covers some themes that are really... I mean, most children's books, and we've had this previously when we were going through other Anne of Green Gables, a lot of children's books actually discuss some fairly profound and challenging topics. Madeleine Liang, Elle Montgomery, there's a bit of you can see they're influenced by their particular faith background, and it does come across through their writing a little bit, but it's not overtly preachy, like hammer nail, not this particular book. I can't remember if one of her other books does become a little bit like that. But it's influenced by this ethical framework, or this challenge of the individual, the challenge of looking beyond the surface. And actually, most children's books that are adventure books or that are science fiction are about crisis and rising up and, you know, actually developing as a person. So it's a coming of age tends to be an inherent feature of a lot of children's literature, mm-hmm. which makes it good. Children and young adult literature, if you're ever needing something to kind of make you go back and reflect on, well, who am I as a person? What are the foundations that I'm built on? That kind of thing. It's actually pretty good that way. Also, there's science, which will always make me happy. There are themes that are, they're difficult, but it's also kind of, it's weird enough to be well done. Weird, but well done weird. And it's not...
So the oddities are delightful instead of distracting.
Yes. I mean, there will be language and expressions that are a little bit, some of them would have been dated by now, but we're not talking like, obviously it's children's literature, so it's not as explicit kind of language as you would see, say, in Catch-22 or similar. But there are moments where sometimes I might elect to, and with no disrespect to the authoress, but I might elect to use a different word simply because I'm not personally comfortable with that word. Mm. And it's only because the meaning is much more severe than it is intended at the time, because people have now been more and more conscious, or I'm at least more conscious of what the meaning of the word carries, mm-hmm. what meaning of the words carry.
Well, what will happen is in those instances, you folks won't even hear the word. If you listen to Catch-22, you will probably be familiar with the censor sound effect I used for certain words, and that will make a return.
Yeah. It's not often. It's just once in a while when, as you see, there will be challenges. There'll be the way that people speak to others, or I'll just acknowledge in the, or I'll warn at the beginning of a chapter, like I've been doing in the past, or warn or note that there will be language in there, certain words that are used. So we'll see how we go. Some words we might decide to keep, and we'll just add a note at the beginning to say, just a heads up, this word makes an appearance.
Yeah, we'll play it by ear. And yeah, so, I mean, even though you're making this warning before we start, I don't think it's going to even be comparable to Catch-22,
nothing.
In terms of offensive language, probably out of everything we've read so far, was high and above every other book we've covered.
It was definitely on the top, yeah. And I think the only reason I like to mention it is because it can be a bit jarring when, for example, we're adults and we're reading children's literature, and then hearing a word that has a different and a much more heavy connotation as maybe would have been without being aware of what the word means truly. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So that can be a bit jarring in a different kind of way. However, that being said, as Dave put it, we'll play it by ear, see how it goes. And I find it a delightful kind of series of books. It is challenging in some ways, but it's also delightful because there's just that the imagination, the part of the imagination that tends to be evoked by children's literature particularly, does tend to be the one where it's wonder and awe, and that what if, but imagine. And it encourages that part of your mind to expand it a little bit again. And that's good. I think it's important.
It is a bit of a cliche, but the idea that adults often lose the sense of wonder that they had when they were children.
I think try and if you find it relaxing, it's relaxing. If it's not that relaxing, because there are some moments of adventure, there is a Disney movie that has been released. If you have watched this, it doesn't differ that much. Just you'll probably have faces and scenarios imagined for you. Like you'll have certain actors that you visualize in that role. Okay, it's okay. No issue really. But if you haven't watched the movie, please consider not watching it until the book is finished, because it will probably make it a better experience.
And I'll just say right now, just like actually everything that Rue's read so far, I have not read A Wrinkle in Time. And I am just like when Rue suggested Anne of Green Gables, I have a similar response where I'm very much looking forward to this.
Yeah, it's just something different. I like pushing us away from the dystopians, can you tell? Although this one has moments where it does a contrast. There's no Anne of Green Gables kind of situation. That was, most of it was just light, light, da, 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 but then oof.
There was that chapter of heavy.
Yeah. Well, technically there was more if you scratch beneath the surface, mm-hmm. but. Yeah. Let's not not recapping Anne of Green Gables, and I'll try my best not to do continuous.
Yeah, go back and listen to that series of our podcast. It was a delightful book, and I think we had some good conversation.
Yeah, it was fun. That was our season two. Season two was Anne of Green Gables by Ellen Montgomery.
But we're much more well seasoned now.
Season six. Oof. Yes. Now, chapter one. Mrs. What's It? There is in mine a small illustration of a shoddy looking trilby on top of like a shawl looks like a shawl. You may not have this, and it's okay.
I do not.
It's okay. It was a dark and stormy night. In her attic bedroom, Margaret Murray, wrapped in an old patchwork quilt, sat on the foot of her bed and watched the trees tossing in the frenzied lashing of the wind. Behind the trees, clouds scudded frantically across the sky. Every few moments, the moon ripped through them, creating wraith-like shadows that raced along the ground. The house shook. Wrapped in her quilt, Meg shook. She wasn't usually afraid of weather. It's not just the weather, she thought. It's the weather on top of everything else. On top of me. On top of Meg Murray doing everything wrong. School. School was all wrong. She'd been dropped down to the lowest section in her grade. That morning, one of her teachers had said crossly, "Really, Meg, I don't understand how a child with parents as brilliant as yours are supposed to be can be such a poor student. If you don't manage to do a little better, you'll have to stay back next year." During lunch, she'd roughhoused a little to try and make herself feel better, and one of the girls said scornfully, "After all, Meg, we aren't grammar school kids anymore. Why do you always act like such a baby?" And on the way home from school, walking up the road with her arms full of books, one of the boys had said something about her dumb baby brother. At this, she had thrown the books on the side of the road and tackled him with every ounce of strength she had and arrived home with her blouse torn and a big bruise under one eye. Sandy and Dennis, her 10-year-old twin brothers, who got home from school an hour earlier than she did, were disgusted. "Let us do the fighting when it's necessary," they told her. "A delinquent. That's what I am," she thought grimly. "That's what they'll be saying next. Not mother, but them. Everybody else. I wish father..." But it was still not possible to think about her father without the danger of tears. Only her mother could talk about him in a natural way, saying, "When your father gets back..." Gets back from where? And when? Surely her mother must know what people were saying, must be aware of the smugly vicious gossip. Surely it must hurt her as it did Meg. But if it did, she gave no outward sign. Nothing ruffled the serenity of her expression. "Why can't I hide it too?" Meg thought. "Why do I always have to show everything?" The window rattled madly in the wind, and she pulled the quilt close about her. Curled up on one of her pillows, a grey fluff of kitten yawned, showing its pink tongue, tucked its head under again, and went back to sleep. Everybody was asleep. Everybody except Meg. Even Charles Wallace, the dumb baby brother, who had an uncanny way of knowing when she was awake and unhappy, and who would come so many nights tiptoeing up the attic stairs to her. Even Charles Wallace was asleep. How could they sleep? All day on the radio there had been hurricane warnings. How could they leave her up in the attic in the rickety brass bed, knowing that the roof might be blown right off the house and she tossed into the wild night sky to land who knows where? Her shivering grew uncontrollable. "You asked to have the attic bedroom," she told herself savagely. "Mother let you have it because you're the oldest. It's a privilege, not a punishment." "Not during a hurricane, it isn't a privilege," she said aloud. She tossed the quilt down on the foot of the bed and stood up. The kitten stretched luxuriously and looked up at her with huge, innocent eyes. "Go back to sleep," Meg said. "Just be glad you're a kitten and not a monster like me." She looked at herself in the wardrobe mirror and made a horrible face, baring a mouthful of teeth covered with braces. Automatically, she pushed her glasses into position, ran her fingers through her mouse-brown hair so that it stood wildly on end, and let out a sigh, almost as noisy as the wind. The wide wooden floorboards were cold against her feet. Wind blew in the crevices about the window frame, in spite of the protection the storm sash was supposed to offer. She could hear wind howling in the chimneys. From all the way downstairs, she could hear Fortinbras, the big black dog, starting to bark. He must be frightened, too. What was he barking at? Fortinbras never barked without reason. Suddenly, she remembered that when she had gone to the post office to pick up the mail, she'd heard about a tramp who was supposedly to have stolen 12 sheets from Mrs. Buncombe, the constable's wife. They hadn't caught him, and maybe he was heading for the Murrays' house right now, isolated on a back road as it was. And this time, maybe he'd be after more than sheets. Meg hadn't paid much attention to the talk about the tramp at the time because the postmistress, with a sugary smile, had asked if she'd heard from her father lately. She left her little room and made her way through the shadows of the main attic, bumping against the ping-pong table. "Now I'll have a bruise on my hip on top of everything else," she thought. Next, she walked into her old doll's house, Charles Wallace's rocking horse, the twins' electric trains. "Why must everything happen to me?" she demanded of a large teddy bear. At the foot of the attic stairs, she stood still and listened. Not a sound from Charles Wallace's room on the right. On the left, in her parents' room, not a rustle from her mother sleeping alone in the great double bed. She tiptoed down the hall and into the twins' room, pushing again at her glasses as though they would help her see better in the dark. Dennis was snoring. Sandy murmured something about baseball and subsided. The twins didn't have any problems. They weren't great students, but they weren't bad ones either. They were perfectly content with a succession of B's and an occasional A or C. They were strong and fast runners and good at games, and where cracks were made about anybody in the Murray family, they weren't made about Sandy and Dennis. She left the twins' room and went on downstairs, avoiding the creaking seventh step. Fort and Bra had stopped barking. It wasn't the tramp this time, then. Fort would go on barking if anybody was around. But suppose the tramp does come? Suppose he has a knife? Nobody lives near enough to hear if we screamed and screamed and screamed. Nobody's care, anyhow. I'll make myself some cocoa, she decided. That'll cheer me up. And if the roof blows off, at least I won't go off with it. Very practical. In the kitchen, the light was already on, and Charles Wallace was sitting at the table, drinking milk and eating bread and jam. He looked very small and vulnerable sitting there alone in the big, old-fashioned kitchen. A blonde little boy in faded blue Dr. Dentons, his feet swinging a good 6 inches above the floor. Hi, he said cheerfully. I've been waiting for you. From under the table where he was lying at Charles Wallace's feet, hoping for a crumb or two, Fortinbras raised his slender dark head in greeting to Meg, and his tail thumped against the floor. Fortinbras had arrived on their doorstep, a half-grown puppy, scrawny and abandoned one winter night. He was, Meg's father had decided, part Llewellyn setter and part greyhound, and he had a slender dark beauty that was all his own. "Why didn't you come up to the attic?" Meg asked her brother, speaking as though he were at least her own age. "I've been scared stiff." "Too windy up in that attic of yours," the little boy said. "I knew you'd be down. I put some milk on the stove for you. It ought to be hot by now." How did Charles Wallace always know about her? How could he always tell? He never knew, or seemed to care, what Dennis or Sandy were thinking. It was his mother's mind and Meg's that he probed with frightening accuracy. Was it because people were a little afraid of him that they whispered about the Murray's youngest child, who was rumoured to be not quite bright? I've heard that clever people often have subnormal children, Meg had once overheard. The two boys seemed to be nice regular children, but that unattractive girl and the baby boy certainly aren't all there. It was true that Charles Wallace seldom spoke when anybody was around, so that many people thought he had never learned to talk. And it was true that he hadn't talked at all until he was almost 4. Meg would turn white with fury when people looked at him and clucked, shaking their heads sadly. "Don't worry about Charles Wallace, Meg," her father had once told her. Meg remembered it very clearly because it was shortly before he went away. "There's nothing the matter with his mind. He just does things in his own way and in his own time." "I don't want him to grow up to be dumb like me," Meg had said. "Oh, my darling, you're not dumb," her father answered. "You're like Charles Wallace. Your development has to go at its own pace. It just doesn't happen to be the usual pace." "How do you know?" Meg had demanded. "How do you know I'm not dumb? Isn't it just because you love me?" "I love you, but that's not what tells me. Mother and I have given you a number of tests, you know." Yes, that was true. Meg had realized that some of the games her parents played with her were tests of some kind, and that there had been more for her and Charles Wallace than for the twins.
"IQ tests, you mean?"
"Yes, some of them."
"Is my IQ okay?"
"More than okay."
"What is it?"
"That I'm not going to tell you, but it assures me that both you and Charles Wallace will be able to do pretty much whatever you like when you grow up to yourselves." See that sentence there? That's interesting, isn't it? Whatever you like, that kind of, the dad and the mum in this are just like, wow. Like, they're really awesome. But when you grow up to yourself, it's not growing up to meet a certain formula. It's growing up to meet who you, the direction that you wish to take as a, as an adult.
Or finally growing into who you are, which I sadly think that many people never get there.
No, and I think it's interesting.
You just wait till Charles Wallace starts to talk. You'll see. How right he had been about that, though he himself had left before Charles Wallace began to speak, suddenly, with none of the usual baby preliminaries, using entire sentences. How proud he would have been. My brother, by the way, he did that. One of my brothers did that. Wouldn't talk for ages. And then when he started to talk, he started later than all of us, and then it was full sentences. Not just, you know, he was the one that it was the hardest to encourage him to express himself. He would just go, like that. And then, within a very short time, after, I don't know, some age, suddenly it was like, full sentence. Hmm. Could you please pass me the mango? Like, woof.
You'd better check the milk, Charles Wallace said to Meg now, his diction clearer and clearer than that of most five-year-olds. You know I don't like it when it gets skin on top.
You put in more than twice enough milk, Meg peered into the saucepan. Charles Wallace nodded serenely. I thought Mother might like some. I might like what? A voice said, and there was their mother standing in the doorway.
Cocoa, Charles Wallace said. Would you like a liverwurst and cream cheese sandwich? I'd be happy to make you one.
Yeah, look, that would be lovely, Mrs. Murray said, but I can make it myself if you're busy.
No trouble at all, Charles Wallace slid down from his chair and trotted over to the refrigerator, his pajamaed feet padding softly as a kitten's.
How about you, Meg? Sandwich?
Yes, please, she said, but no liverwurst. Do we have any tomatoes?
Charles Wallace peered into the crisper. One. All right if I use it on Meg, Mother.
To what better use could it be put? Mrs. Murray smiled. But not so loud, please, Charles. That is, unless you want the twins downstairs, too.
Let's be exclusive, Charles Wallace said. That's my new word for the day. Impressive, isn't it?
Prodigious, Mrs. Murray said.
Meg, come let me look at that bruise.
Meg knelt at her mother's feet. That is hard to pronounce, guys.
Folks, that's hard. Meg knelt, because the G and the kn. Oh. Kn. Yeah, g-kn.
Meg knelt at her mother's feet. The warmth and light of the kitchen had relaxed her so that her attic fears were gone. The cocoa steamed fragrantly in the saucepan, geraniums bloomed on the window sills, and there was a bouquet of tiny yellow chrysanthemums in the center of the table. The curtains, red with a blue and green geometrical pattern, were drawn and seemed to reflect their cheerfulness throughout the room. The furnace purred like a great sleepy animal. The lights glowed with steady radiance outside, alone in the dark. The wind still battered against the house. But the angry power that had frightened Meg while she was alone in the attic was subdued by the familiar comfort of the kitchen. Under Mrs. Murray's chair, Fortinbras let out a contented sigh. Mrs. Murray gently touched Meg's bruised cheek. Meg looked up at her mother, half in loving admiration, half in sullen resentment. It was not an advantage to have a mother who was a scientist and a beauty as well. Mrs. Murray's flaming red hair, creamy skin, and violet eyes with long dark lashes seemed even more spectacular in comparison with Meg's outrageous plainness. Meg's hair had been possible as long as she wore it tidily in braids. When she went into high school, it was cut, and now she and her mother struggled with putting it up. But one side would come out curly and the other straight, so that she looked even plainer than before. I'm going to translate plainer as meaning not meeting conventional beauty standards, but you know.
You don't know the meaning of moderation, do you, my darling? Mrs. Murray asked.
A happy medium is something I wonder if you'll ever learn. That's a nasty bruise the Henderson boy gave you. By the way, shortly after you'd gone to bed, his mother called up to complain about how badly you'd hurt him. I told her that since he's a year older and at least 25 pounds heavier than you are, I thought I was the one who ought to be doing the complaining. But she seems to think that it was all your fault.
I suppose that depends on how you look at it, Meg said. Usually, no matter what happens, people think it's my fault, even if I have nothing to do with it at all. But I'm sorry I tried to fight him. It's just been an awful week, and I'm full of bad feeling.
Mrs. Murray stroked Meg's shaggy head.
Do you know why?
I hate being an oddball, Meg said. It's hard on Sandy and Dennis, too. I don't know if they're really like everybody else, or if they're just able to pretend they are. I try to pretend, but it isn't any help.
You're much too straightforward to be able to pretend to be what you aren't, Mrs. Murray said.
I'm sorry, Meglet.
Maybe if Father were here, he could help you, but I don't think I can do anything till you've managed to plough through some more time. Then things will be easier for you. But that isn't much help right now, is it? Maybe if I weren't so repulsive looking, maybe if I were pretty like you. Mother's not a bit pretty. She's beautiful, Charles Wallace announced, slicing liverwurst. Therefore, I bet she was awful at your age. How right you are, Mrs. Murray said. Just give yourself time, Meg. Lettuce on your sandwich, Mother? Charles Wallace asked. No, thanks. He cut the sandwich into sections, put it on a plate, and set it in front of his mother. Yours will be along in just a minute, Meg. I think I'll talk to Mrs. Watsit about you. Who's Mrs. Watsit? Meg asked. I think I want to be exclusive about her for a while, Charles Wallace said. Onion salt? Yes, please. What's Mrs. Watsit stand for? Mrs. Murray asked. That's her name, Charles Wallace answered. You know the old shingled house back in the woods that the kids won't go near because they say it's haunted? That's where they live. They? Mrs. Watsit and her two friends. I was out with Fortinbras a couple of days ago. You and the twins were at school, Meg. We liked to walk in the woods, and suddenly he took off after a squirrel, and I took off after him, and we ended up by the haunted house. So I met them by accident, as you might say. But nobody lives there, Meg said. Mrs. Watsit and her friends do. They're very enjoyable. Why didn't you tell me about it before? Mrs. Murray asked. And you know you're not supposed to go off our property without permission, Charles. I know, Charles said. That's one reason I didn't tell you. I just rushed after Fortinbras without thinking. And then I decided, well, I'd better save them for an emergency anyhow. A fresh gust of wind took the house and shook it, and suddenly the rain began to lash against the windows. I don't think I like this wind, Meg said nervously. We'll lose some shingles off the roof, that's certain, Mrs. Murray said. But this house has stood for almost 200 years, and I think it will last a little longer, Meg. There's been many a high wind up on this hill. But this is a hurricane, Meg wailed. The radio kept saying it was a hurricane. It's October, Mrs. Murray told her. There have been storms in October before. As Charles Wallace gave Meg her sandwich, Fortinbras came out from under the table. He gave a long, low growl, and they could see the dark fur slowly rising on his back. Meg felt her own skin prickle. What's wrong? She asked anxiously. Fortinbras stared at the door that opened into Mrs. Murray's laboratory, which was in the old stone dairy right off the kitchen. Beyond the lab, a pantry led outdoors. Though Mrs. Murray had done her best to train the family to come into the house through the garage door or the front door, and not through her lab. But it was the lab door and not the garage door towards which Fortinbras was growling. You didn't leave any nasty-smelling chemicals cooking over a Bunsen burner, did you, Mother? Charles Wallace asked. Mrs. Murray stood up. No, but I think I'd better go see what's upsetting Fort, anyhow. It's the tramp. I'm sure it's the tramp, Meg said nervously. What tramp? Charles Wallace asked. They were saying at the post office this afternoon that a tramp stole all Mrs. Buncombe's sheets. We'd better sit on the pillowcases, then, Mrs. Murray said lightly. I don't think even a tramp would be out on a night like this, Meg. But that's probably why he is out, Meg wailed, trying to find a place not to be out. In which case, I'll offer him the barn till morning. Mrs. Murray went briskly to the door. I'll go with you, Meg's voice was shrill. No, Meg, you stay with Charles and eat your sandwich. Eat, Meg exclaimed as Mrs. Murray went out through the lab. How does she expect me to eat? Mother can take care of herself, Charles said. Physically, that is. But he sat in his father's chair at the table, and his legs kicked at the rungs, and Charles Wallace, unlike most children, had the ability to sit still. After a few moments that seemed like forever to Meg, Mrs. Murray came back in, holding the door open for, was it the tramp? It seemed small for Meg's idea of a tramp. The age or sex was impossible to tell, for it was completely bundled up in clothes. Several scarves of assorted colours were tied about the head, and an old man's felt hat perched atop. A shocking pink stole was knotted about a rough overcoat, and black rubber boots covered the feet. "Mrs. Watsit," Charles said suspiciously, "what are you doing here, and at this time of night, too?" "Now don't you be worried, my honey." A voice emerged from among turned-up coat collar, stole, scarves, and hat, a voice like an unoiled gate, but somehow not unpleasant. Mrs. What's-it says she lost her way, Mrs. Murray said. Would you care for some hot chocolate, Mrs. What's-it? Charmed, I'm sure, Mrs. What's-it answered, taking off the hat in the stall. It isn't so much that I lost my way as that I got blown off course, and when I realized that I was at little Charles Wallace's house, I thought I'd just come in and rest a bit before proceeding on my way. How did you know this was Charles Wallace's house? By the smell, Mrs. What's-it untied a blue and green paisley scarf, a red and yellow flowered print, a gold liberty print, a red and black bandana. Under all this, a sparse quantity of greyish hair was tied in a small but tidy knot at the top of her head. Her eyes were bright, her nose a round, soft blob, her mouth puckered like an autumn apple. My bit it's lovely and warm in here, she said. Do sit down, Mrs. Murray indicated a chair. Would you like a sandwich, Mrs. What's-it? I've had liverwurst and cream cheese. Charles has had bread and jam, and Meg lettuce and tomato. Now let me see, Mrs. What's-it pondered. I am passionately fond of Russian caviar. You peaked, Charles cried indignantly. We're saving that for Mother's birthday, and you can't have any. Mrs. What's-it gave a deep and pathetic sigh. No, Charles said. Now you mustn't give in to her, Mother, or I shall be very angry. How about tuna fish salad? All right, Mrs. What's-it said meekly. I'll fix it, Meg offered, going to the pantry for a can of tuna fish. For crying out loud, she thought, this old woman comes barging in on us in the middle of the night, and Mother takes it as though there weren't anything peculiar about it at all. I bet she is the tramp. I bet she did steal those sheets, and she's certainly no one Charles Wallace ought to be friends with, especially when he won't even talk to ordinary people. I've only been in the neighbourhood a short time, Mrs. What's-it was saying, as Meg switched off the pantry light and came back into the kitchen with the tuna fish. And I didn't think I was going to like the neighbours at all until dear little Charles came over with his dog. Mrs. What's-it, Charles Wallace demanded severely, why did you take Mrs. Buncombe's sheets? Well, I needed them, Charles dear. You must return them at once. But Charles dear, I can't. I've used them. It was very wrong of you, Charles Wallace scolded. If you needed sheets that badly, you should have asked me. Mrs. What's-it shook her head and clucked. You can't spare any sheets. Mrs. Buncombe can. Meg cut up some celery and mixed it in with the tuna. After a moment's hesitation, she opened the refrigerator door and brought out a jar of little sweet pickles. Though why I'm doing it for her, I don't know, she thought, as she cut them up. I don't trust her one bit. Tell your sister I'm all right, Mrs. What's-it said to Charles. Tell her my intentions are good. The road to hell is paved with good intentions, Charles intoned. My, but isn't he cunning? Mrs. What's-it beamed at him fondly. It's lucky he has someone to understand him. But I'm afraid he doesn't, Mrs. Murray said. None of us is quite up to Charles. But at least you aren't trying to squash him down, Mrs. What's-it nodded her head vigorously. You're letting him be himself. Here's your sandwich, Meg said, bringing it to Mrs. What's-it. Do you mind if I take off my boots before I eat? Mrs. What's-it asked, picking up the sandwich, nevertheless. Listen, she moved her feet up and down in her boots, and they could hear water squelching. My toes are ever so damp. The trouble is that these boots are a mite too tight for me, and I can never take them off by myself. I'll help you, Charles offered. Not you, you aren't strong enough. I'll help. Mrs. Murray squatted at Mrs. What's-it's feet, yanking on one slick boot. When the boot came off, it came suddenly. Mrs. Murray sat down with a thump. Mrs. What's-it went tumbling backward with the chair onto the floor, sandwich held high in one claw. Water poured out of the boot and ran over the floor and the big braided rug. Oh, dearie me, Mrs. What's-it said, lying on her back in the overturned chair, her feet in the air, one in a red and white striped sock, the other still booted. Mrs. Murray got to her feet. Are you all right, Mrs. What's-it? If you have some liniment, I'll put it on my dignity, Mrs. What's-it said, still supine. I think it's sprained. A little oil of cloves mixed well with garlic is rather good. And she took a big bite of sandwich. Do please get up, Charles said. I don't like to see you lying there that way. You're carrying things too far. Have you ever tried to get to your feet with a sprained dignity? But Mrs. Watsit scrambled up, righted the chair, and then sat back down on the floor, the booted foot stuck out in front of her, and took another bite. She moved with great agility for such an old woman. At least Meg was reasonably sure that she was an old woman, and a very old woman at that. Mrs. Watsit, her mouth full, ordered Mrs. Murray, "Now pull while I'm already down." Quite calmly, as though this old woman and her boots were nothing out of the ordinary, Mrs. Murray pulled until the second boot relinquished the foot. That's a good term phrase there. This foot was covered with a blue and grey argyle sock, and Mrs. Watsit sat there, wriggling her toes, contentedly finishing her sandwich before scrambling to her feet. "Ah," she said, "that's ever so much better," and took both boots and shook them out over the sink. "My stomach is full, and I'm warm inside and out, and it's time I went home." "Don't you think you'd better stay till morning?" Mrs. Murray asked. "Oh, thank you, dearie, but there's just so much to do. I can't just waste time sitting around frivoling. It's much too wild a night to travel in." "Wild nights are my glory," Mrs. Watsit said. "I just got caught in a downdraft and blown off course." "Wait at least until your socks are dry. Wet socks don't bother me. I just didn't like the water squishing around in my boots. Now don't worry about me, lamb." Lamb was not a word one would ordinarily think of calling Mrs. Murray. "I shall just sit down for a moment and pop on my boots, and then I'll be on my way. Speaking of ways, pet, by the way, there is such a thing as a tesseract." Mrs. Murray went very white, and with one hand reached backward and clutched at the chair for support. Her voice trembled. "What did you say?" Mrs. Watsit tugged at her second boot. "I said," she grunted, shoving her foot down in, "that there is, shove, such a thing, shove, as a tesseract." Her foot went down into the boot, and grabbing shawls and scarves and hat, she hustled out the door. Mrs. Murray stayed very still, making no move to help the old woman. As the door opened, Fortinbras streaked in, panting, wet and shiny as a seal. He looked at Mrs. Murray and whined. The door slammed. "Mother! What's the matter?" Meg cried. "What did she say? What is it?" "The tesseract," Mrs. Murray whispered. "What did she mean? How could she have known?"
Now, so the unflappable Mrs. Murray is flapped. So please, I leave you to reflect.
It's a very nice introductory chapter. I like the focus on family. I like the fact that the young boy has such an odd, like they refer to him with his like full titled name. Mm. Meanwhile, the twins each have their singular name and Meg is just Meg. It's something I liked about Anne of Green Gables as well, although I think this is more reflective because it's more of a modern book. So its language reflects at least our modern English a little better, but just something I marvel at with children's writing is even though, you know, the word choice, the vocabulary choice is simple because it has to be. You can't use too many complex words, although right at the end they threw out the word tesseract, and I'm sure they're going to explain that one. But, like, even though the language is more simplistic than most literature, I found at least in this chapter, like, the sentences were able to express their ideas remarkably well in short time as well. Not needing a lot of space to say much.
Yeah. There's a very dynamic nature to the way that she writes. I mean, many children's books are, that's why they're fun to read, because they move. There's a movement.
Mm.
But more importantly, like, you've got this whole... You have to remember, a five-year-old went and met and conversed with three old women that are living in a place that everyone else in the town thinks is haunted. Kid also knows whenever anyone's awake, usually ahead of them before they do. So is always prepared when they're awake, comes up when they know they're... Like, it's just... So the kid's a bit uncanny.
And I like when... Mrs. Watsit said, you know, I forget the language, something about you let him be himself, or you don't try and squash him.
Yeah.
Very similar to how they were talking about how when Meg was talking to her father about him, he's like, oh, all in all due time.
Yeah. And I mean, he, same the mum. Yeah.
Yeah. Mrs. Murray said, oh, I think he's far ahead of all of us. We don't really understand him.
Yeah. And then you also had Mrs. Murray also pointing out to Meg, you just had time. You need time. Mm. You will grow at your pace.
Well, Charles Wallace keyed into that as well. The idea that mother's beautiful, so she must have looked like you when she was young.
Yeah. Yeah. And also, I think the meaning of beautiful is beyond that skin deep.
Mm.
And usually when a child says beautiful, you know, we're talking, oh, look at the sunset. It's beautiful because it, you know, it's pretty, right? That's why there's that distinction that Charles Wallace makes, the distinction between pretty and beautiful. Pretty is a superficial surface thing. Beautiful is something that involves greater depth.
Mm.
And normally we would read and go, oh, 5-year-old, yeah, whatever. Like it's just, it's being pedantic. This is a character who, despite their age, is meaning exactly what that, like that, the deeper meaning of that word.
Mm. And yeah, I never, well, maybe it's the way it's written because everyone else in the story takes him completely seriously. So like him being a 5-year-old, because I don't think his age was actually mentioned.
No, it was mentioned. It was okay. Mentioned briefly.
But you know, that never crossed my mind. Like, obviously, I know he's a kid, but I just, you know, I guess took him at face value.
Well, also the fact that his sister, who's a teenager in high school, speaks to him as a peer.
Mm. And fights on his behalf, too.
Oh, yeah, for sure. Because he doesn't really talk to many people. And that might be, well, that's, yeah.
I do like how, you know, that Meg fought that boy because he was disparaging towards Charles Wallace. And the boy's mother phoned Mrs. Murray up. And Mrs. Murray said, well, look, your son got into a fight with my daughter. He's older than her. He's larger than her. I should be complaining to you. And the woman just didn't get it.
Yeah, there's a lot of that. Because everything, and also Meg sees that as reinforcing that everything that she does is wrong, not because of her mother, but because of everyone else around her reinforcing that, or at least she perceives it that way as well.
Yeah.
Bearing in mind, so one of our main characters here is a 5-year-old boy who's very, very precocious. Yep. You've got Mrs. Watson, who's obviously something. She's quirky and weird. I love how Charles is like, no, boundaries. You are not touching the caviar. No. You're not having... How does she know?
Mm-hmm.
How does she know what's in the house if they've been hiding away stuff for the mom?
And she tended to... I don't think she literally read Meg's mind, but when Meg was wondering about if she's to be trusted, she said, I have good intentions.
Yeah. And Charles wouldn't protect, but said, look, grow down.
Yeah.
So it's clever, clever kid. And in the meantime, you've got, it is interesting. So you've got some characters that are curious and strange and not quite, you know, they're not quite, it's not, and you know, when it came to the post office and the teacher and the schoolmates and how they speak, can you see, you can relate to that because you can see that kind of person. You've encountered that kind of person usually somewhere, or you've seen a media depiction of something like that, where they're like insincere, like, so have you heard from your father lately? Smile, sweet, sugary smile, and not being sincere.
It did seem to, like, that the impression I got was also that it's kind of like this family is in its own like little bubble, and it's almost like them and then the rest of the world is a very different thing.
Yeah. So they are unique in where they live. They stand out. I mean, the teacher, did you remember what he said? For someone whose parents are supposedly smart.
Yeah.
Supposedly world famous scientists or like, you know, who are very smart.
Or even, you know, people backhandedly complimenting the twins for just being normal kids because they're not extraordinary. They get Bs and they coast by, but everyone likes them and they're good at games and, you know.
Also notice how Meg pointed out, I don't know if they play themselves down.
Yeah, no, judging by at least Meg and Charles Wallace, they could be purposely riding that line.
Mm. Of they also might have a bit more social intelligence, at least in terms of their, they're not as easily affected by the, they know how to navigate. They can, they recognize how to navigate. But yeah, so far, first impressions, it's interesting.
It's good. It's like it.
I love the cliffhanger. It's like, wait, what? Mrs. What's-It drops a bomb and then just leaves.
Mm. In her hurricane of scarves.
Yeah. Wild nights are my glory. She's an interesting character. And Morsha. No. So yes, I think the way that it's done in this, the way the author, the way Madeline writes the mother, and the mother is almost like entirely unflappable. And Charles Wallace, when Meg's like worried, says, don't worry, mum can look after herself physically.
Mm.
Charles knows more in terms of the other stuff, knows, has deeper, almost uncanny insight.
Mm.
But that what Mrs. What's-It said completely threw her for a loop.
Yeah.
Yeah. So obviously.
Now I'm guessing the Tesseract has nothing to do with the MCU.
Not that way, no. I mean, there'll be more because you know that the kids are going to ask, what is a Tesseract? And so that's going to be a conversation that has to happen. Otherwise, you don't set up the premise.
I have my notions because I think I've encountered that in science fiction before. But, you know, like a lot of things in sci-fi, you have to see how each story is going to use the thing in its own way. Kind of like how every story with vampires tends to use vampires and the lore of vampires a little differently.
Much to Anne Rice's frustration. Oh, well. May she rest in peace. Anyway, so yes, I'm glad you're enjoying it so far.
Mm.
It is kind of one of those things where it builds up a pace, so it's harder to disrupt the flow, but it's just a bit tricky.
No, it's to me that's too... qualities of an excellent book for me. I mean, there can be other things especially in the literature space, you know, the great classics, they can be very tough to get through, but can be rewarding in their own way. I'm almost at the end of the Brothers Karamazov at the moment, and that is very dense and very difficult to get through, but I'm enjoying it. But with this, you know, it's got qualities that I really enjoy in books like Dresden and Discworld, where the pace is very quick. Because the pace is quick, like, you just want to keep reading.
Yes.
And that's where I am right now. I want to record another episode, but I feel that would be on both us at the moment.
Yeah, it's too hot and my voice is going.
So I will wait with positive anticipation for next episode.
It is one of those books where we will probably flow through it rather fast.
Mm.
But then we also have moments where we can discuss like concepts a bit more deeply because it gets fun. So yes. And on that note, the music at the head of the podcast is a score composed by Jeff Danner for a teleplay adaptation of A Wrinkle in Time from 2003. The music at the end of the podcast, as always, is I Am the Slime by Frank Zappa. And you can find me on Twitter at RooMcMoo, that's RooMcMoo.
And I'm over on Twitter at Dave_the_Turnip. You can find our podcast's Twitter page and Facebook page at SMBSLTPodcast. And if you add @gmail.com to the end of that, you get our email. Now, if you have any feedback upon the episode, upon the discussion, the books we're choosing, books you'd like to see us cover in the future, please let us know. We'd love to hear from you. And if you listen to our podcast on any site or app that allows you to rate or review it, we would appreciate that as well.
And so until next time, we wish you happy reading, and we will find out next week What is a tesseract, or at least why that word evoked such a reaction from Mrs. Murray?
Bye, folks.